excited to introduce Tony Seaton, who has produced Great Lives, and the book is on the back table, and he's working in collaboration now with the Pinecone. I know you're seeing his articles. He's a professional writer, public speaker, business and political consultant, and communications specialist. He also covered Watergate as a reporter, 6 elections, 5 space shots, produced Barbara Walters news interviews, and won a handful of national awards for his business economics coverage for the ABC network. And I'm sure there's so much more, but I'll let him tell you. And we're so honored to have you here today. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you all for skipping work and school to come out and hear this today. You know, when you get on an airplane, just before it's about to take off, they announce, make sure that you're going to this particular destination. And so any of you who thought you were in Denver for the presidential debates, that's later.
Please.
The Great Lives series came about because I wound up meeting Paul Miller at a political function in April. I had been trying to reach him for about 8 years. He and I shared some duties together. He was at CBS and NBC when I was at ABC. And we met for lunch at Fandango's, and he had this idea for me to do profiles of the people in this peninsula. It's an extraordinary place that we live in, and there are many great minds and big hearts who live here. I think there's something in the water that attracts us. Paul decided that we should call this Great Lives, and he is also responsible for the headlines. I write the stories and take the pictures. There are 2 aspects to the Great Lives series. It's the writing and the interviewing. And let me give you a little background. I was an award-winning broadcast journalist, mostly for ABC, as Ann mentioned. It seems like so long ago. It was so long ago. Anyone remember Watergate? I have also written more than 2,500 essays and a dozen books. Locally, I wrote for The Weekly. I did restaurant reviews for them and a couple of other pieces. They decided they didn't want my work anymore because when I was working for the Pinecone, the publishers, in case you didn't know it, at the Pinecone and The Weekly are in something of a feud, so I could only write for one. I also write profiles for 65 Degrees. And the new issue comes out, I think, this week. They have, for the first time, decided to publish some fiction, and I have a piece on Sherlock Holmes. Well, it's sort of fiction. You're an aficionado. It's real. Yeah. I'm also currently writing something called Monterey.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I'm
which is an online series featuring Francie Leveal, who is the greatest consulting detective since Sherlock Holmes. She lives down at Yankee Point, and the cases that she solves are all set here on the peninsula. The first episode that I wrote ran online on December 1st, and it's called Doc. And it's about a physician who, local physician, very popular, who ran for Congress and somehow won. The somehow was that the candidate, the incumbent, was perfectly well entrenched until about 3 weeks before the election, when he was caught in a motel room in San Juan Bautista with his chief aide by her husband, who walked into the motel room with a shotgun and blew away the television. Anyway, that knocked the incumbent out of the race. Doc got in touch with Francie Leveal to say, I need some help. I found out that someone is stealing drugs from my office. And Francie said, well, that's really something that the police can handle. And they can find out who it is and take care of it. And Doc said, I know who it is. I want it stopped. And the drugs in question were OxyContin and Vicodin. So I don't know whether you remember, but on December 1st of last year, a guy broke in, well, he went up to the counter with a weapon at Ordway and demanded drugs. OxyContin and I think Valium or something like that. And it was such an amazing coincidence that I got the Herald to publish a statement in the next day's paper to say that this was not a marketing gimmick on the part of the mystery. I started writing professionally when I was 13. I was writing, as many writers do today, many journalists do today. I started writing sports for the local paper. I got 10 cents per column inch, sort of what I was getting for the weekly. I wrote my first fiction when I was 15 at the Smith College Northampton High School summer school. It was a contemporary theater course, and I had to write a paper and submit it, even though the grades didn't matter. And it was due on a Monday. I wrote it on a Sunday, knocked it out on yellow paper. Remember the yellow math type paper? Straight in about 3 hours, handed it in without typing it over or even rereading it, and won second place, which was $2. I didn't frame it, I spent it, but it was, as I said, I was on my way. I started writing for Good Morning America 2 years on an overnight shift, and then since then, after journalism, I've been writing poetry, business plans, press releases, and hundreds of radio and television spots. I also wrote commentary and recorded it, distributed it nationally. The commentaries were called Seton Notes. S-E-T-O-N is my last name, and Seton Notes is spelled backwards as Seton, so Seton Notes was a palindrome. I could not write, of course. Yeah. I did that for about 11 years, and then I finally became discouraged that the world wasn't listening to what I had to say. I found that I was tempted to repeat some of the things that I had already written and produced, so I decided to turn to fiction. Yes, I love it. My fiction is all contemporary, and it deals with current issues. I follow the line that McLuhan said that anyone who doesn't understand that entertainment and education are inextricably entwined doesn't understand either. So the first story I wrote was called Truth Be Told, and it was about a woman, a law professor at a university who was being hit upon by another law professor. And that part was true. I tweaked it a little bit, put in a couple of subplots, and wound up publishing the book about 2 weeks before, 6 weeks before the actual trial in this case went to court. And it was about 12 hours before the judge was going to start to hear testimony that the defense decided that this book would get too much publicity and it would make things look bad, so the case was settled just before the court started. The second novel I wrote was called Silver Lining. I wrote it in the week after Tucson, after the shootings at Tucson, and it's based on the notion that crazy people shouldn't be allowed to have guns. I know some people bridle at that, but the third book was called The Omega Crystal, and it was about solar energy and how the oil industry was sitting on major developments in photovoltaic cells and power storage. In the opening of the book, I said, does anyone not believe that that's the case? No, everyone knows that they're sitting on this stuff, and we could be free of our oil dependence if we could make that happen. But again, these are fictional stories based on where we are today. The fourth book had a great title. It's five short stories, and the title is The Autobiography of John Doe Gigolo. It's about a former hedge fund manager who decided to spend his life helping women get their lives back together. And the five women are two divorcees, two widows, and a gangster's mall. Yeah, women like them, though. The fifth book was Mayhem, and it was a story about a woman who was trying to kill her ex-husband through stress. Based on a true story. And the final novel, these were all published last year, the final novel was called Just Imagine, and it's about how we actually have the ability to see people's auras, and we just don't realize it. It's taught out of us at an early age. But in fact, it's true. And there was a scientist up in Mendocino who developed a device that could see with photographs of real people, something he called parallel spectrographic recoloration, so that, isn't that a good title? It takes an image and it displays the aura of an individual on that image, and the aura shows someone's integrity, someone's character, someone's level of consciousness.
Walk around.
I still do some journalism with these Great Lives series. But the fiction is what is so captivating to me. There was a woman in Marin County named Shirley Luthman, a philosopher of sorts, who said, "No writer worth his salt can deny having sat down and taken dictation." My style, because I started in television news, essentially, is to write first and edit later. And my mother was a writer. She used to write, despite having five children and a large house to clean, 500 words a day. And I will write 5,000 words a day. And it's just the style of letting it come through you, taking that dictation, and then go back and say, oh, my God, why did I write this? And how do I explain it? Because the plots sometimes get ahead of you. The novels that I wrote were with a director's eye. I expect that someday some Hollywood agent will discover them and say, oh, my God, they're all movies. You're all invited to the premieres. I also have been doing a lot of publishing of other people's stories. Oh, first, I should say, I've done nonfiction. I wrote Phil Butler's book. Phil Butler is was a POW in Vietnam for 8 years, and his book is called Three Lives of a Warrior. I wrote a book for Bill Monning in the 2010 race called Vision for a Healthy California. I wrote Herma Smith Curtis's life story called From Terror to Triumph. I'm working on a book on higher consciousness. We'll leave that there. And I'm also writing Denny Levesque's life story. Well, exciting moments, at least. I've been writing some, publishing some other books. Gerard Rose, whom many of you probably know, is on the city council here and is an attorney. I got in touch with him. We see each other regularly, and he mentioned to me that he had written a book 10 years ago about the struggles in Ireland around 1915, 1917. He called the book Connolly after the name of his chief protagonist. And I said, okay, I want to see it. He said, no, it's 10 years. He gave me the book on October 3rd, and I published it on October 26th. That's what you can do these days. It had a new title. I downplayed one of the many romances. But it's a very good historical novel. And I pushed him to do more. So in March, he came up with another one. It was based on Joshua Barney, who was a great hero of our revolution and the War of 1812. He was a naval hero. And he started when he was crossing the Atlantic in a clipper ship, a cargo ship, in 1775. At the age of 15 and a half, the captain, midway across the Atlantic, in the middle of a storm, died. And Joshua Barney was the only one who knew anything about navigation, so they made him the captain. So, as I say, went on to become a hero of the Revolution and the War of 1812. And we changed the book title to The Boy Captain. It's a very interesting story, and those of you who are familiar with the people in this area will recognize a great many names because Gerard likes to put those in. He also, in August, we published his latest book called Bless Me, Father, and it's a story of a young man growing up in California in the middle of the last century, going to Vietnam, going to college, finding the great love of his life, having to leave her. It's a very, very dear story, and he's now working on another one called For I Have Sinned. He's also working on several volumes of children's stories. I also did a book by Hugh Wilson called Live Better Longer, and it's obviously nonfiction. Yeah, it should be. And it's about how people who reach 30 have to realize that they can keep themselves in much better health if they pay attention to a couple of important things like their hormonal balance and exercise and diet, things most of us have already heard, but it's a very well-written book and very clear. That's the writing and publishing side. I've done over 2,500 interviews. In 2006, I wound up doing over 250 interviews with House, Senate, and gubernatorial challengers in that election cycle. The interviews ran about 20 minutes, and they were for people all over the country in every state. And sometimes there would be candidates who were sort of not very into the interview itself and became monosyllabic, so that I would pose to them a question about the immigration issue. And I would say, let me run by you an idea that I had for how to deal with the illegal immigrants. You know, like there are 12 to 15 million illegal immigrants. And I said, what would happen if we rounded them all up and bused them to Texas and then gave Texas back to Mexico? Well, some of them laughed, but not all of them. I thought it was a good idea. On a more serious note, another question that I raised with these candidates was about hyphenates. Hyphenates are African American, Latin American, Indian, Native American, that sort of thing.
Oh, and I said,
do we think it's a good idea that we put something before American? Why shouldn't we be American first? Why, whoever is living here, who are citizens here, why can't we be Americans first? And when I asked the question of white candidates, every one of them, well, it's not for me to say. And every one of the black candidates said, oh my God, yes, in my lifetime, let it be. It's very powerful. When I was with ABC, producing Barbara Walters' news interviews, we were at the Kempinski Hotel in Berlin. It was the hotel where John Kennedy stayed when he did his Ich bin ein Berliner speech. And in fact, we shot the interview in the same suite that Kennedy stayed at. And I raise this because the interview with Schmidt had this very poignant note to it. He was sitting back in his chair smoking a cigarette, and Barbara, putzing around with things and talking to the hairdresser and this, that, and the other thing, said, okay, well, now I want you to know that what I need you to do, I'll ask a question, give me a very short answer. And Schmidt says, that's what all you Americans say, you reporters, you say, I want them, they ask a very, very long question, and then they want a short answer.
He was right.
We also, that trip caught Jimmy Carter at the Palais Schomburg. There were no press supposed to be in the area when this was the G7 summit, when the presidents were leaving, but we snuck in and got an exclusive interview. And it was an interesting situation because Carter came down the stairs from the Palais Schomburg, and Barbara and I eased our way over next to it. We didn't have a camera crew, but the German television, ZDF, had two cameras on site, one in the back and one over on the side. So I sort of moved Jimmy and Barbara over so that that camera would take them because it was closer, and I had a little micro cassette recorder. And we got all of 37 seconds or 39 seconds of audio, and then I got back to the studio and we married it. We led the news with it. Poor John Chancellor had what he thought was an exclusive interview with Carter that had been done earlier that day.
Oh, we scooped him.
The process of interviewing here is, I've talked to a lot of people I already knew and many people whom I haven't. And I've learned from all of them that there's character hiding behind those faces that we just see walking by in the street or seeing in the newspaper or something like that. So, for instance, when I talked to Sue McLeod, she told me, I wrote, on a fortuitous trip back through Washington, she visited with some friends from Carmel. It turned out that the husband was with the CIA. When he heard Sue's story about not being allowed to join the CIA because she was a woman, he arranged an interview for Sue the next day with the head of the professional training program for the people who run clandestine operations. A very nice man, Sue recounted. Unfortunately, he had four daughters, and he did not think it was an appropriate occupation for a young woman. One of his questions was, if you had to go down to the docks of Amsterdam at 2 o'clock in the morning, what would you think and how would you do it? And Sue replied, well, I have been to Amsterdam, and I am aware of that famous street where the ladies ply their trade in storefront windows. If I were dressed appropriately and acting appropriately, I'd be more at home at the docks on the docks at 2 o'clock in the morning than some man in a suit with an attaché case. She got the job. She served with the agency from 1963 to 1995. With my traditional journalistic instinct, I asked, "What are the things you can't talk about?" And she said, "Oh, I can talk about anything. I just have to shoot you."
Yeah.
The people whom I've spoken to, and I'll read some more pieces in a moment, I just want to say, I want to talk to interview celebrities, and the answer is no. And the reason is because they've already been asked all the questions. What am I going to add to it? I like to find out what people are thinking and ask them questions on the basis of what the audience would be interested in finding out. I mean, so many of these people have been interviewed countless times. I remember reading a story about that actress Stone. Who's the?
Sharon Stone,
that's right. She had a book come out, and she did 50 interviews in one day and changed for each one of them. Yeah, I know. We don't have that problem here, thank goodness.
Yeah.
So the first person I did was my friend Stansel Johnson. Yeah. He is a psychiatrist, and I met him in March of 1986 because he's also a Sherlock Holmes aficionado, as I am. And this is some of what I wrote about him. With all his psychiatric experience, what is his diagnosis of our society? Has he bust down over the cliff? "No, not yet," he said. "But I describe myself as an optimistic fatalist. I'm not unique in this, but I believe we've seen the best in the United States we're going to see. We reached our acme, our zenith. No country lasts forever. Think of the four stages of an empire, and like Britain, we're descending. We have a lot of clout, but we're not going to be the big, big guy. And maybe we'll be better for it. Maybe." His abiding fascination and love is of animals. He is currently writing a life's lessons book featuring his two Jack Russell Terriers. Quote, "I'm very interested in why humans think they are the only significant animal. Animals are far closer to nature than we humans are. I like the line by the guy who said, 'If I get to heaven and there are no dogs there, I ain't going in.' I kind of feel that way." Stansel Johnson's overview, "We have a lot to learn, and I think if we learn some of it, we will have a better world psyche." Shaba Ajan is the owner of Portobello, and he was recommended to me by Paul. "We sat at a table toward the back of Portobello after the lunch hour for a 45-minute interview that pushed 2 hours. No complaints. He is a marvelous raconteur, and with all of his experience, he could tell stories forever. His European savoir-faire is miles deep, but he was quietly aware of the reservations for that evening and how the back dining room was being arranged, and yet he was always present with me and polite. He spoke of living through the horror of the Second World War with a light air, dropping such phrases as the Nazi glamour days, with only a soupçon of telling wryness. That didn't make light of the circumstances. He went on to reference the political forces that moved Europe's European borders as the result of wars, and to discuss the various cultures with their histories and their languages. An unhurried lunch with this man would infuse one with more knowledge of Europe than a year of college studies." Dan Cort, former mayor of Pacific Grove, was raised in a Jewish household, though only occasionally went to temple. Quote, it was more secular than religious, but the values were get yourself educated, do the right thing, and don't take a lot of crap. My father embodied that, my grandfather embodied that, and I tried to do that in my life. He added, "It's all about giving back. Whatever you get, you have to give back. It's the balance of life." Was this part of his Jewish heritage? He answered, "It's everyone. I think it's good for your soul." Phyllis Cleveland was a 747 pilot for United. If you've been on a 747, the cockpit is 56 feet above the tarmac. 56 feet. Mm-hmm. Think of like a five-story building. That's where you're guiding this massive plane from. She's done some talk in the area about how she was in the air during 9/11 and brought into Vancouver along with the other planes that were coming across the Pacific. But here is one story that has not come out. "Every flight is a normal flight until it isn't. She was flying right seat, meaning co-pilot, in a 747 that was taking off from Los Angeles en route to Tokyo. They were rolling down the runway and beginning to lift off, but they were caught in a wind shear and couldn't rise. In fact, they were sinking, and the sand dunes at the end of the runway were getting closer, fast. With the crew and passengers, there were 368 souls aboard. Phyllis slammed forward the four throttles to maximum power. The aircraft, fully loaded with fuel for the trip to the other side of the world, rose above the runway and cleared the sand berm at the end of the runway by 20 feet. We literally left a rooster tail on the sandbar, she said. It wasn't until later that she was told by the flight engineer that at the moment she firewalled the throttles, she said, "Fly, you son of a bitch." Peter Barascini is a noted screenwriter, lives in Pebble Beach when he doesn't have to be in L.A. I started as a journalist. It was back in the days when you had a deadline. You had to find a payphone, scribbling as you went. Then you'd call in your story. I had a big romantic notion about the newspaper business, he said, when I started out. I remember the first time I walked into the newsroom. I had fantasies of wearing an overcoat and a hat with a press pass sticking out of it. There was a sports reporter I knew from his byline, and he had his wife on the phone, and his mistress was in the lobby yelling at him through the newsroom. There was another guy I gave a story to. I'd written about Carmel High School defeats Monterey High School in Titanic wrestling match. And the guy looked at it, and he said, "This stinks," and then, "Fix it. You've got 4 minutes." And that was my introduction to the newspaper business. Alison Malik, the artist. Alison is a rare bird. She is a fascinating contrast of the thoughtful muse royal artist and a startlingly efficient design professional. Rarely the twain shall meet, and in Alison they not only meet, but they sing. When did Alison first get inspired to be an artist? "Well, I didn't call it art," she said, "but when I was about 3.5 years old, I was inspired to draw on the walls. And I was mesmerized because I was drawing these forms, and they were coming to life. They were becoming shapes. They were becoming people. But my mother came down the hall with a look on her face that this was not good. And I said, 'Mommy, look at how I made the wall pretty.' And this just melted her heart, and she couldn't punish her budding artist. She got me crayons and paper, and I've never been without art supplies since." Nat Adriano. When someone excels at their chosen work, you often wonder what got them started on their path. Nat Adriano played on the Monterey High School football team back in 1948. The Herald subsequently called it the Monterey County All-Sports Team of the Century. Did Nat go on to play for the 49ers? No. He became the presiding justice at the 6th District Court of Appeals. After MHS, he went to Berkeley. He didn't really apply himself, perhaps because he didn't know what he wanted to do. His major was business administration. He thought he would go into real estate. Then one day, he walked a friend over to Bolt Hall, where the friend was picking up an application for law school. Quote, "When I got there, there was a door with a legend moot court above it. I opened the door and looked in, and I was intrigued when I saw the bench, the jury box, the witness chair." He went home and he told his wife that he thought it looked interesting. His wife said, "Why don't you go for it?" This was a story from Denny Levesque's book. There was a time at age 16 when Denny Levesque, the governor of Iowa, and his wife were a boat ride on the Iowa Falls River during 4th of July festivities. They were at the top of the dam when the motor stopped and wouldn't restart. Denny jumped over the startled couple, switched the fuel tanks. Then he jumped back, restarted the boat, averting what could have been a disaster by about 10 feet. He also remarked that neither the governor nor his wife seemed particularly appreciative. Lisa Bryan is our famous artist who makes maps and paintings out of maps. Lisa Bryan's father, who had been a thespian during the London Blitzkrieg, had taken up painting as a hobby when they had moved over to Canada. He didn't make a lot of money at it, but he loved it, and daughter Lisa watched him work excitedly. It just seemed like a natural thing, like watching mom cook and bake. And I was given canvases that he didn't like, and he would flip them around and restretch them and give them to me, and I would paint. In her early teens, she was already so good that she won some awards for her work. During those critical growing up years, quote, I was a horse nut too, and all my spare time was with my horse. It kept me out of trouble. A lot of my girlfriends were getting pregnant and falling by the wayside, but I had my horse, my animals. She laughed. They were a great inspiration to me. I was kind of a loner, and I think by painting horses, I thought I would be recognized as a person. She was long overshadowed by her more voluble parents and brother. Quote, so I would paint these big, powerful paintings, and it was like shouting out loud. I was painting out loud. Bill Sharp, you'll know him in a moment. Bill Sharp was on the cutting edge of new financial economics. This was made clear years after the fact, very early one October morning in 1990. At 4 o'clock, the phone rang in his hotel room in Tucson, where he was attending an economics conference. Shaking the sleep from his ears and getting past the presumption that it was a crank call, Bill learned that he had been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. His wife, Kathy, wondered what the call was about. He wrote on a piece of paper, Nobel. Brilliant, contributing to the common weal, Bill Sharp is humble. I'm just a hardworking guy who got lucky. Dorothy Fennell. She was sent to a very conservative college for women that felt like a straitjacket. In her first year, during the height of the McCarthy era, when told she needed to write a major paper, she got permission from her instructor to discourse on the guilt or innocence of Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers. She spent hours working on that paper. The night of the freshman prom, she managed to throw on some clothes and to meet her date. But on the dance floor, all she could think about was her paper. She didn't even realize what was happening when she was named queen of the prom. Soon afterwards, she handed in her paper and then spent anxious days waiting for it to be returned. It was worth the wait. When she got the paper back, the professor had written on it, I have never given an A-plus before. I'll read one more. I'm not giving up politics, not in the least bit, Rich Pepe said first thing. We were sitting in Vesuvio, his year-old Carmel restaurant. Rich, a self-described old hippie, was wearing a red, white, and green t-shirt that read, Make Pizza, Not War. You were the only one who tried to talk me out of it, he added. I scoffed. A number of people who had said to his face that he didn't want to be mayor. Think of all those five-hour meetings, he was told by myself and others. That's not you. Think of all the crazy people insisting that you were their personal representative. That's not you. But he didn't listen. He ran. He garnered a respectable number of votes against the Imperial Burnett machine. They didn't actually publish it that way, Paul. That was a little too harsh. I thought it was What did he think of the elections process? Pepe said, I think for a small town it went very, very well. It was interesting. It was exhilarating. It really was. It was like a boxing match. You knew you were going to get hit. You just didn't know how bloody you were going to get. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I was thrilled about it. Those are some of the pieces that I've done. I've got four on the shelf right now. One is Greg Profeta, Bob and Judy's son, who was a banker, mortgage banker, very successful mortgage banker for 20 years, and now runs The Forge, The Forge in the Forest. And he's turned it around dramatically loves what he's doing. Another one is Dominic Mercurio. Dominic has the two restaurants in the Wharf, Cafe Fina and Domenico's. Man. He is a very bright, dear fellow. And these things tie all in together. Next, October 15th, I'm starting a new serial story of Francie Livial. And Dominic Mercurio is in the story, in the first and last chapters of it. Debbie Davis, the chanteuse at Mission Ranch and at the Cypress. I profiled her. She's going to be in the upcoming weeks. And Detlef Bittner, who has Bittner's pen emporium. When I interviewed him, I said, it doesn't seem like a store or a shop. I mean, not when you can spend $10,000 on a pen.
Yeah, right.
But as I say in my story, I met him. I went into his emporium, showroom is the other word, when I started the Monterey Mystery, and I said, would you like to advertise? You're the first person I'm asking. And he said immediately, yes. And then we started talking about Sherlock Holmes because of the connection with Francis Leviat. And then he said, I think I know the pen that you want. You're going in the wrong direction. This pen, which is only $175, not $10,000, I have been looking for the right pen for 48 years, and this is it. It is so special to me that I will not let anyone try it. This is a retractable fountain pen. Retractable fountain pen. It doesn't drip in your pocket. And it writes, has fine point, medium point. Anyway, the reason why this is a semi-commercial announcement, I got Detlef to agree to offer discounts to any of you who might want. And you don't have to get the $10,000 pen. You can get less expensive ones. He has writing paper and things like that. And I got some little stickers that I put on the Monterey Mystery card. So if any of you is interested and wants to go up, bang, zoom, you got a great deal. Some more things to wrap up. I also, after I did the interviews with the candidates in 2006, I was stunned at how poorly most of them did with the interview. And so many people who are attracted to politics feel that this gives them an opportunity to get on a soapbox and speak for as long as they want. And that doesn't work. But what I did was I wrote a book called The Quality Interview, Getting It Right on Both Sides of the Mic, which most of you would have absolutely no use at all for. But I brought some, and I will autograph them and give half the proceeds to the Carmel Foundation if you have space on your bookshelf and you feel you need one of these. I also would welcome any suggestions for doing profiles as part of the Great Lives series. And at the greatlives@tonyseaton.com or any one of my other addresses, I would welcome your suggestions. I have interviewed a number of people among the 25, 6, 7, or 8 whom I've done based on suggestions from people I don't even know, but who get the idea of what's going on and how to knit this community ever closer together by recognizing the quality of the minds and hearts of the people here. Questions? Sir?
What is your take on the future of city newspapers? Is that unfair?
No. I was just trying to think, how do I say this politely? I think that Pinecone's the best one we have.
I'm not talking about Pinecone.
I understand. I got into trouble with the Herald because I said at some point a couple of years ago that dead fish would crawl out of the Herald.
I agree.
What happened was the Herald and a number of other papers were taken over by Dean Singleton of Media News, I think is the company. Yeah. And it's all about bottom line and not about serving the area. And what needs to be done is a group of people in this area on the peninsula have to raise the money to buy the paper and then bring it back to the peninsula and just have it be the Monterey Peninsula Herald again. Because the demographics are very concise here, and people read newspapers here, and people want to be informed here, and they would buy a newspaper, and they would get it delivered every day. But to extend your coverage and your delivery over the rest of the county makes it impossible. I mean, they are making money, but it's not... It's not a fulfilling experience to read the paper, unless you're just looking at the obituaries to make sure your name is.
Or if they got it spelled right.
Well, thank you very much for your
Thank you very much.